Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast episode 62. This one is called The Grain Offering. And if you've listened to the previous two podcasts in this series on Leviticus, you know that Leviticus is a continuation of the book of Exodus. Exodus ends with the Israelites being freed, and then they build a tabernacle or a home for God in the wilderness. Once they build this, we read that God descends upon the tabernacle, fills the tabernacle with God's glory, and Exodus ends. We turn the page and Leviticus begins, and now God is in the tabernacle speaking to the Israelites. Now, the first five chapters of Leviticus are God telling the Israelites about five different sacrifices that God would like for them to practice regularly. And so Leviticus 1 is the chapter that focuses on the olah. And the olah is the burnt offering. And as we talked about in the last episode, the burnt offering reminds us that God hears human beings. And as we look at Leviticus 2 today, we are going to look at the mincha. And the mincha is the grain offering. And Leviticus 2 is ultimately a continuation of Leviticus 1. The difference is, rather than sacrificing animals, we now read about sacrificing grain or wheat or bread. So with that in mind, I'd like for us to read about the mincha. And I'd like for us to read what this sacrifice entails, because it's very similar to Leviticus 1. And ultimately what we're looking for is the inspiration behind the interpretation of Leviticus 2. We read, "When anyone presents a grain offering to the Lord, the offering shall be of choice flour. The worshiper shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it, and bring it to Aaron's sons and priests. After taking from it a handful of the choice flour and oil with all its frankincense, the priest shall turn this token portion into smoke on the altar, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord. And what is left of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons, a most holy part of the offerings by fire to the Lord." Now, I'd like for us to pause there and notice what material is to be offered with the grains, and that material is frankincense. Now, frankincense was meant to symbolize riches or extravagance or the extra things in life. And so when God asks for the mincha, he asks for Israelites to offer this understanding and acceptance of riches and extravagance and the extra beauty of life as part of the offering. Now, not everyone can afford that. And so in verses 4 to 10 of chapter 2, we read about people who can't afford to offer frankincense. And this is the offering that God provides. Let's read verse 4. God says, "When you present a grain offering baked in the oven, it shall be of choice flour, unleavened cakes mixed with oil, or unleavened wafers spread with oil. If your offering is grain prepared on a griddle, it shall be of choice flour mixed with oil, unleavened. Break it into pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. If your offering is a grain prepared in a pan, it shall be made of choice flour and oil. You shall bring to the Lord the grain offering that is prepared in any of these ways, and when it is presented to the priest, he shall take it to the altar. The priest shall remove from the grain offering its token portion and turn this into smoke on the altar, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord. And what is left of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is a most holy part of the offering by fire to the Lord." I'd like to share another aside before we move on to verse 11. And the aside I'd like to talk about is another ingredient that is asked to be left out of this grain offering. That ingredient is yeast, or anything that would cause bread to become leavened. Now, this is a strange thing to request, but yeast, or the fermentation of bread, was ultimately viewed as a symbol of life. And the idea was that you place things on the altar that were dead or had no more connection to life. So when God specifies that he wants unleavened bread on this altar, of course that makes sense, because as we read in chapter 1, God also asks that dead animals are sacrificed. So the things that touch the altar are not brimming with life, but are in fact dead, or symbols of death. So unleavened bread is a symbol of death. Now, most Christians today are familiar with unleavened bread because it's part of the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper. But the whole mentality or the whole symbolism behind this symbol, and the reason we have wine and unleavened bread, is because it has to do with fermentation. And fermentation of food was considered a symbol of life. And if you go back to the Passover story, the whole idea behind the Passover story is that Egyptian sons had to die so that the Israelite people could essentially be given life of freedom. And so you eat unleavened bread to remind yourself of the death of what was before, and you drink wine to remind yourself of the life that is now possible because of freedom. And so you drink unfermented bread and fermented wine to remind yourself of the death and the life of this Passover experience. Now, some people drink grape juice for this symbol, and that's fine, and more power to them. But ultimately, what these symbols are about is fermentation and representing life and death. Verse 11 of chapter 2 in Leviticus says this: "No grain offering that you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you must not turn any leaven or honey into smoke as an offering by fire to the Lord. You may bring them to the Lord as an offering of choice products, but they shall not be offered on the altar for a pleasing odor. You shall not omit from your grain offerings the salt of the covenant with your God. With all your offerings you shall offer salt." Now, salt was often used to preserve food back in the Levitical age. And so salt was, as the text says, a symbol of God's covenant with their people. Because after all, salt made food last longer. So naturally, God would tell his people to remember the promise of the covenant, even in the face of death on the altar. So salt was asked to be presented alongside this offering of bread or grain or flour to remind the participant of the endurance of God's promises. And now the last three verses of the chapter. Verse 14, God says, "If you bring a grain offering of first fruits to the Lord, you shall bring as the grain offering of your first fruits coarse new grain from fresh ears, parched with fire. You shall add oil to it and lay frankincense on it. It is a grain offering. And the priest shall turn a token portion of it into smoke, some of the coarse grain and oil with all its frankincense. It is an offering by fire to the Lord." And so chapter 2 ends, and we read about the Minha. Now, what's fascinating is that this is considered a sacrifice. And sacrifice within the ancient Hebraic language was drawn from the Hebrew word or Hebrew verb that meant to draw near. And so the understanding was that you would take this grain or flour or bread, give most of it to the priests, and then light a portion of it on fire, and all of a sudden you would be brought closer to God. Which raises a fascinating question, doesn't it? How on earth does lighting bread on fire bring a human being closer to God? Seriously, have you ever tried lighting bread on fire? If you haven't, give it a shot, under correct adult supervision, mind you. But ultimately, give it a shot and see how much closer you feel to God because you've lit some bread on fire. My guess is that if you were to light some bread on fire right now, you probably wouldn't feel this overwhelming sense of reverence or closeness or nearness to God. So what on earth is Leviticus 2 and the Minha and the grain offering getting at that would ultimately bring a human being closer to God? What inspired Leviticus 2 and this ritual, this ancient ritual, that people passed down from generation to generation and said, if you do this, you will be brought closer to God? Well, in order to understand that, let's consider Leviticus 2 and Leviticus 1, the Olah and the Minha. Now, the Olah is about sacrificing either a steer or a sheep or a bird, while Leviticus 2 is about sacrificing bread. So in other words, Leviticus 1, the Olah, and Leviticus 2, the Minha, are about food. And when you consider what food really is, it's something that we take for granted. I think the best summary of what food is summed up by a man named Alex Atala, who is a chef in Brazil and is considered one of the world's greatest chefs. He once said, "Behind every dish is death." Well, that's rather shocking, and it's a bit of a morbid way to look at life. But think for a moment what he says when he's bringing forth this idea, "Behind every dish is death." If you look at the food that you eat, almost everything that we eat was at one point alive. But when you eat it, we come face to face with the fact that something died so that we might live. An animal gave his or her life so that you could keep going forward. Apples that we eat were one point living and connected to a tree, but the minute we pick them, they begin to die. Grains are the same. They were living, they were connected to the ground, and then they were harvested, and from that moment forward, they were dying. Something died so that we might live. When you give food this kind of weight and this kind of reverence and this respect, we have to admit that the food that we eat is sacred. Now, you may think that I'm going too far or that I'm too new age or I'm too much of a hippie, but let's look at the definition of sacred. Sacred is an adjective, and the definition is connected with God or the gods or dedicated to a religious purpose and so deserving veneration or respect. When you hear the phrase, something died so that you might live, it immediately brings a lot more respect to food, doesn't it? Not only that, to label it as connected with God instantly calls to mind the ritual that most Christians participate in, this ritual of saying grace before a meal. When Christians pause and pray before a meal, they are thanking God for the source of their food. They are thanking God that God gave life at one point, and this life has stopped so that we might keep going. And when you look at this ritual that is so commonly practiced by Christians today, it is all a reverence or a posture or a respect that is paid to food because we recognize that the food that we eat is sacred. And if we really believe that the food that we eat is sacred, then we also have to believe that the lives that we fuel with this food are sacred. All of a sudden, when food has that much respect and that kind of sanctity, the lives that we live that are fueled by this sacred food and the choices that we make are ultimately sacred as well. I'd like to tell you a story about my daughter. My daughter is 3 years old, and she is a lot of fun to be around. And every morning, I get to feed her. I get the responsibility of preparing her breakfast. And so my daughter loves all kinds of food. She loves waffles. She loves yogurt. She loves berries. She likes a lot of different kinds of food. But there was one Sunday in particular where we fed her food, and then shortly after she ate breakfast, she put on her soccer uniform because she's part of a soccer team. Yes, my daughter at 3 years old is in a 3 to 4 year old soccer league, and she's on the green team. And I have the privilege of coaching her and 7 of her friends. We play at the Drayson Center every Sunday morning, and it is just a blast to watch and to coach this team. And you may ask yourself, well, what is 3 to 4 year old soccer like? Well, during practice, we're often interrupted by a spontaneous game of duck, duck, goose. And when we play games, every now and then we'll lose a player because he stops playing and starts looking for ladybugs. So you kind of got to hold the whole competition thing loosely. But this green team has worked hard. I'm really proud of them. They're a great group of kids, and they've improved in their skills. And so it's been fun to watch these young kids develop an appreciation and understanding of soccer at such a young age. Now, I tell you this story because Maya ate breakfast, she put on her uniform, and then we were playing the blue team. And as we were playing the blue team, my daughter Maya somehow ended up with the ball. And when she ended up with the ball, she started going toward the goal. She was going the right way. And I remember thinking to myself, my word, my daughter has a chance at scoring her first goal. Now, at that moment, if you would have paused reality and asked me, Craig, where on earth would you rather be than right here? I would not have said I want to go to Easter Island. I would not have said I want to go to Hawaii. I would not have said I want to go to Europe. I would have said I want to be right here where my daughter has her chance at scoring her first goal. I say this because my daughter's only going to score her first goal once. This was a wholly irreplaceable moment that I did not want to miss. And so my daughter was taking the ball toward the goal, and I will have a video of it, but I will just play you the audio so you can hear what it sounds like when my daughter scored her very first goal. It's fascinating to me how this was an insignificant event in the history of the world, and yet it was one of the highlights of my life, my daughter scoring her first goal. And yet this was all made possible because my daughter got up in the morning and ate breakfast. She ate things that were at one time living and are now dead so that she could somehow accomplish this physical feat. And after she scored a goal, we kept playing for a few more minutes, and then we called the game. It was over. And then it was time for Maya's favorite part, which, of course, is the snacks after the game. And so we have this moment that I would call a holy, sacred, irreplaceable moment, surrounded by food and made possible by food, because the lives that we fuel with this food are, in fact, sacred. So the food we eat is sacred. The lives we fuel are sacred, and therefore, if we were to take the minha very seriously, the earth where we harvest our food is sacred. Now, let me ask you a question to illustrate this point. I want to ask you, where do you get your food from? Now, you may have said Walmart, or Vons, or Albertsons, or Costco, or Trader Joe's. But understand that this is a relatively new answer in the history of humanity. Not too long ago, if you would have asked humans, where do you get your food from, they would have said the orchard, or the field, or the farm. And when you consider the convenience of a modern supermarket and how different it has made our relationship with food, you realize how much of a revolution we're living in. We can now go to a produce aisle and pick out just about any kind of natural produce we want any time of the year. Not only that, but when we shop in the middle of the grocery store, we walk down giant canyons of food stacked higher than we are. Imagine how mind-boggling that would have been to people 100 years ago. Not only that, but have you ever stopped to look at the sheer amount of variety we have when we walk the aisles of supermarkets? There are so many different kinds of bread and so many different kinds of cereal and so many different kinds of canned vegetables and canned fruits. It's overwhelming. And I tell you all this because our relationship with food has changed. Food and the way that we relate to it and get it and acquire it is very different today than food and humanity 100 years ago. And when we consider what food represents for us today, we have to understand that the gap between humanity and the origin of our food is larger than ever before. We are further away from the production and harvesting and growing of our food than human beings have ever been before in the history of the world. To give you an idea of how big this gap is, a few years ago, I went to a place called the Donut Man in Glendora, California. Now, the Donut Man is famous for putting fresh strawberries and fresh peaches on fresh donuts. And so my friend Sam was telling me about how amazing these fresh strawberries on a donut were. And so I shortly after that drove down to Glendora to the Donut Man and said, "Hi, I'd like a donut with fresh strawberries on it." At that point, the person working the cash register rolled his eyes at me and said, "Bruh, it's March." To which I responded, "Yeah, it's March. So what?" And he said to me, "Strawberries are out of season." The embarrassing part of this story is I had never even thought about strawberries being out of season. And to this day, without looking it up, I don't know when strawberries are in or out of season. Now, if we could somehow open a time portal and my great-grandparents, Alfred and Mary Grace Olson, could look at me today trying to order a strawberry donut in March, I have a feeling that my great-grandpa, Alfred Olson, would look at me and say, "Craig, you are such an embarrassment." But this happens because the gap between humanity and the origin of our food is larger than ever before. We are so far away from where food grows that we are not even influenced by the seasons in which the food grows. This is why people will travel all around the world to go closer to their food, to close that gap between their own lives and where food is grown. One of America's most famous restaurants is Blue Hill at Stone Barns in New York. And you can go to this farm and you will eat on the farm. And one of the first things they serve you is three little splotches of butter. Now, if you are unrefined like me, you will turn to the waiter and say, "Excuse me, what is this?" And he will say, "It is single udder butter." And if once again, if you're like me, you don't know what single udder butter is. So you ask, "What is single udder butter?" And he looks at the three different splotches of butter on your plate and says, "Well, each splotch came from one different cow." So the first batch of butter is from Betsy. The second batch is from Deborah. And the third batch is from Bertha. And you can taste to see which cow produces the best butter. And the whole idea behind this dish is to close that gap between humanity and the origin of our food, because all of a sudden you are given a name and reminded that this milk came from a living, breathing, pooping cow. Now, single udder butter is a whole different experience from heating up and toasting a Hot Pocket. Now, I don't know if you've ever looked at the ingredients on a Hot Pocket, but the list of ingredients goes on and on and on, and there are just hundreds of different ingredients that go into this little concoction of chemistry and what some people would call food. And I looked through the different ingredients on a Hot Pocket, and I have to share some of them with you because they're just fascinating that this is somehow in the food that we eat. One of the ingredients was L-cysteine hydrochloride, which doesn't sound like it was farmed. It sounds like it was created in a lab. Another ingredient was disodium phosphate. Another one was imitation cheddar cheese, because we can't put real cheddar cheese in a Hot Pocket. That would just ruin things. Another ingredient was fractionated palm oil. And I don't know if you're thinking of starting an indie band, but the name fractionated palm oil would make a fantastic name for your indie band. Another ingredient in Hot Pocket is dough conditioner, which is distilled monoglycerides with ascorbic acid and citric acid, which in parentheses are antioxidants, which I have to laugh at because people will tell you that antioxidants are good for you, but I can't imagine antioxidants and dough conditioner are actually good for you. And then my favorite ingredient on the whole list was the ingredient flavors with an asterisk next to it. And when you have to ask yourself, well, what are flavors? You look at the asterisk and it just says ingredients not in regular cheddar cheese. So what are flavors? Is it like a yoga mat? Or what is it that's being added to this food that we can't even describe what it is? We're just going to call it flavors. I tell you all this because there is nothing sacred about a Hot Pocket. Yes, a Hot Pocket is sort of food, but there is such a gap between what is actually harvested or grown or lived and what a Hot Pocket is that it feels like it has lost its sanctity and it's not real food. Have you ever been bored with life? Because maybe what you're eating isn't sacred. And maybe if you changed what you ate or grew or turned into food, maybe if you changed it, you would find that your existence is in fact sacred. Because the Minha and the Ola remind us that the food that we eat is sacred. The lives that we fuel with this food are sacred. And the earth where we harvest this food is sacred. In other words, the very life that you live and sustain through food is sacred. And the reason we have these sacrifices in Leviticus 1 and Leviticus 2 is because we often forget that our existence is sacred. We often need to be reminded of the sanctity of our own lives. I know this because this happened to me last Monday when somebody sent me a clip from the Jimmy Kimmel show. Now, Jimmy Kimmel opened his show like any other show that he normally does with a monologue, but he begins this monologue with tears rather than with laughs. He starts getting choked up emotionally, saying, "I'm going to tell you a story, and before I go any further, I want you to know this story has a happy ending. But it is a difficult story to tell." And so Jimmy Kimmel begins to tell a story of his son, Billy, who was born just a week before this monologue. Now, Billy was born. He says it was an easy birth, and his wife just pushed a few times, and then Billy was out, and everybody was happy, and he was declared that Billy was a happy baby. But a few hours after he was born, a nurse named Nanoush noticed that something was different about Billy. Namely, Billy had the wrong kind of color for what a newborn should have. And so Nanoush alerted some of the doctors. They came and looked at Billy, and they would never confirm with Jimmy Kimmel that everything was okay and this wasn't worth worrying about. As more and more doctors came in, Jimmy Kimmel began to worry that something was wrong with his newborn son, Billy. And eventually the doctors told Jimmy Kimmel that his son was born with a heart defect and his son would require surgery immediately. At this point, Jimmy Kimmel begins to sob, and he shares how difficult it was to watch his son go through surgery at such a young age. He then talks about how the doctors were adequately prepared, how they did an amazing job, but he was holding on to this baby, this young little baby that he barely knew that was his own son. And when he came out of the operating room, he just felt this wave of emotion because he realized that his son might make it against all odds. Now, Billy will have to have a few more heart operations down the road, but a few days after that first operation, Jimmy Kimmel then shared a picture of him and his son at home resting, and he thanked every one of the healthcare workers and all the people who had sent him texts and had prayed for him and encouraged him along the way. And then he saved his thanks to his wife and his daughter for last, and he shared them, and he cried through every one of those words. Now, as I was watching this, how do you think I reacted to these words? I sobbed. I was just a water fountain of tears. Now, why did I cry so much at this late night host that I'd never met, never will meet? Why did I cry so much at his story? Well, it's probably because I have a son of my own, and my son is 5 months old, and his name is Bodhi. Now, Bodhi has been a healthy baby from day one, but just the night before I watched this Jimmy Kimmel clip, my son woke up throughout the night with regularity. He kept waking up, kept disturbing my sleep, and by the second or third time he woke me up, I did not wake up with grace and peace in my heart and just loving acceptance of my son. No, the third time he woke me up that night, I was annoyed. I was frustrated. I was just angry that my son would wake me up. And as I watched this clip of a father talking about how he almost lost his son, I began to weep and weep and weep because I had taken my son for granted. I had forgotten that our existence is sacred. And if you've ever taken a relationship of a loved one for granted, you know what I'm talking about. Because you all of a sudden have this moment where you're reminded how fragile life can be and how sacred life is. And we often forget that. And all of a sudden, my son and my relationship with my son was given its proper respect, its proper sanctity, its proper weight. Now, the ancient Israelites had a word for this proper emotional weight of things. And the ancient Hebrew word was kavod. Now, kavod was originally a legal term that referred to the heaviness of something. So if you wanted to make sure that somebody gave you the proper amount of gold, you would weigh the gold's kavod and make sure that it was, in fact, the right weight it should be. So kavod originally meant heavy. But because the Israelites recognized that there was a heaviness or a gravity or a respect to life that needed to be given, they began to translate this word differently and use it to describe glory. And so in the end of Exodus, when God fills the tabernacle, and we read about how the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle, the word that's used there is the kavod of God. So at the end of Exodus, the kavod, the weight, the glory of God filled the tabernacle and gave that little tent space or meaning or gravity or heaviness. And so kavod is essentially a way of saying the emotional weight of things. And so we ask the question at the beginning of this sermon, how on earth does lighting bread on fire bring a human being closer to God? Well, as we've talked about, the Minha reminded us that the food that we eat is sacred. The lives that we fuel with that food are sacred. The earth that we harvest is sacred. And the driving force behind the Minha is that you would take ordinary, regular food, bring it into the glory, the kavod, the weight of God, and place it on the altar, and you would be reminded that the ordinary, regular food that you eat every day is actually filled with the glory of God. In other words, your ordinary life is teeming with the kavod of God, and your ordinary life is no longer ordinary, but it is extraordinary. And when God asks the people of Israel to participate in the Minha and the Olah, God is essentially telling the Israelites, don't wait for sickness or death or suffering or surgeries to break through the superficiality and shallowness of life and remind you that life is sacred. Don't wait for suffering. God instead invites people to come and participate in these sacrifices to remind them before suffering hits that their existence is in fact sacred. You don't have to wait until a late night host tells you he almost lost his son for you to love your son now, to experience the kavod that exists between you and your son. You can remind yourself daily with these sacrifices, the Olah and the Minha. Now, when we talk about modern religion, the tragedy is that we have lost these rituals. We do not practice the Olah and the Minha. Now, it's important for us to remember that rituals come and go. But the inspiration behind these rituals is that you don't wait for suffering to be reminded of the kavod in your ordinary life. So the question that these rituals that we don't practice are asking us today is this: what are you doing to see the kavod in your ordinary life? What are you doing to taste the kavod in your ordinary life? What are you doing to feel and hear and smell the kavod in your ordinary life? Because you need to be reminded that your ordinary life is in fact extraordinary. I'd like to close this podcast by sharing what three different people have done or are doing to remind themselves of the kavod in their ordinary life. The first is from Indian environmentalist Vandana Shiva. She says in her book, The Stolen Harvest, the time has come to reclaim the stolen harvest and celebrate the growing and giving of good food as the highest gift and the most revolutionary act. So all Vandana Shiva says is, remember, the highest gift that you can ever give to other human beings is to grow and give good food away. Grow real food. Harvest real food. And buy real food. And then create it into even better food. Practice the art of cooking and share it with someone. She believes that that is the highest gift and the most revolutionary act. What are you doing to taste the kavod in your extraordinary life? Another person I'd like to tell you about is Martin Luther King Jr. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. is, of course, known for his civil rights activism, but he was also a pacifist, and toward the end of his life, he began actively campaigning against the Vietnam War. And he was assassinated in 1968, but in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. gave his last Christmas sermon, a sermon entitled A Christmas Sermon on Peace. During that sermon, he said, "All life is interrelated. We are all caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. You get up in the morning and go to the bathroom and reach over for the sponge, and that's handed to you by a Pacific Islander. You reach for a bar of soap, and that's given to you at the hands of a Frenchman." And then you go into the kitchen to drink your coffee for the morning, and that's poured into your cup by a South American. And maybe you want tea. That's poured into your cup by a Chinese. Or maybe you're desirous of having cocoa for breakfast, and that's poured into your cup by a West African. And then you reach over for your toast, and that's given to you at the hands of an English-speaking farmer, not to mention the baker. And before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you've depended on more than half the world. How did Martin Luther King see the kavod in his ordinary life? He held simple everyday objects and asked, "Where did this come from? Who made this?" Because he or she is sacred, is valuable, is a child of God, and they deserve my respect. What are you doing to feel the kavod in your extraordinary life? The last person I'd like to tell you about is a man named Maltby Davenport Babcock, who has probably the greatest name in the history of the world. Maltby Davenport Babcock lived from 1858 to 1901, and he was a pastor in upstate New York. Now, one thing he loved to do was walk around the shore of Lake Ontario in the morning and remind himself of his father's world. Babcock was so moved by the beauty of Lake Ontario that he wrote a poem called Terra Beata, which is Latin for Blessed Earth. A few years later, Babcock passed away, and his wife came across the poem Terra Beata. She then published it in a book where it caught the attention of a man named Franklin L. Shepard. And in 1915, 14 years after Babcock's death, Shepard put it to music and renamed it as a song known as This Is My Father's World. This Is My Father's World is my favorite hymn. Why? Because it is a reminder of the kavod in the ordinary. The kavod in the rustling grass, the birds that sing, the sky and the moon and the stars. It is a reminder that our lives are not ordinary, but are in fact extraordinary. And this song and this poem that was written so long ago remind us that every moment we live and every moment we have in reality and every moment of nature is saturated with the divine. And so Maltby Davenport Babcock asks us the same question Leviticus 2 asks us. What are you doing to experience the kavod in your extraordinary life? May you see and embrace the inspiration in all.